Welcome to the Sunstone Magazine podcast, where you get the best of Mormon thought and experience in a succinct package. I'm Stephen Carter. This episode is in honor of Eric Samuelson, who, at the time of this recording, is in hospice care. This article is entitled, The Roots of My Faith, by Eric Samuelson. Eric Samuelson is a retiree from BYU, where he taught playwriting and theater. He is the author of the plays Borderlands, The Plan, and Family, all published in Sunstone. I grew up in Bloomington, Indiana, a college town some 50 miles south of Indianapolis. Bloomington was torn between town and gown, between blue-collar locals and academics. From my house, we could hear stock car racing every summer night. On our way to church, we passed Pentecostal churches by the score, including, memorably, the First Baptist Church. And if you've seen the movie Hoosiers, there really is a basketball hoop in every backyard or driveway. In fact, basketball was what brought the community together. Rural evangelicals who may well have loathed the secular humanism of a major university, nevertheless, showed up at Assembly Hall every Thursday and Saturday to watch the IU basketball team play. When my family moved to Bloomington, there were fewer than 30 members of the church in town, meeting Sundays in the storage room of a liquor store. Our ward was half Hoosier and half academic. Nowhere was this better exemplified than the home teaching partnership of Daniel Ludlow and Ray Hardesty. Ludlow, you all know, the editor-in-chief of the Encyclopedia of Mormonism, and one of the great scholars of Mormonism. He was one of the grad students in my ward. Ray Hardesty was an old sorghum farmer, a backwoodsman, as Hoosier as they come, a man with a third-grade education who had, nonetheless, memorized much of the Bible. He stood resolutely opposed to essentially every innovation in the church.
A word library? A cultural hall? An organ in the chapel?
Ray was against them all, and said so, memorably, every testimony meeting. Brother Hardesty and Ludlow couldn't have had less in common, but they became dear lifelong friends and awesome home teachers. That was our ward. Since I was one of three Mormons in our high school, I hung out with the school's Christians, which meant, for the most part, evangelicals. But my father was a professor, so I also hung out with the university kids. But then, my father was pretty atypical for a professor. He'd been trained as a sheet metal worker and became an opera singer. He taught voice in the School of Music, but he had the skills and the attitudes of a construction worker, a blue-collar opera singer. We didn't have early morning seminary. Too few kids, too scattered, so I met with other Christians every morning in the school for Bible study. And then I took all the AP classes with the professor's kids. I'd meet my Christian friends for lunch, and we'd play hearts and euchre, skipping the Shakespeare study group. I made up for it by serving as editor of the school's creative writing magazine, by writing a weekly column for the school newspaper, and by acting in all the school plays. And we did 5 a year. Then DG showed up. And what had been a more or less peaceful coexistence between the secular and religious turned into confrontation and open warfare. D had been the quarterback for the football team. He's the uncle of a current NFL quarterback, but had turned to Jesus and become the founder of something called the Joy Movement. Joy consisted, he said, of putting Jesus first in your life, others second, and yourself last. J-O-Y. He drove a psychedelic van, the Joy Van, around town, speakers blaring Christian rock. Our principal, an evangelical, held a series of full-on revival meetings disguised as mandatory school assemblies. Dee would preach and lead us in songs like Put Your Hand in the Hand and Spirit in the Sky, and then urge us all to invite Jesus to become our personal Savior. When parents found out about these assemblies, they were outraged, and the whole issue became both contentious and litigious. Eventually, the principal was forced to relent, and shortly thereafter, D.G. was disgraced and criminally prosecuted when it turned out he'd been sexually involved with underage girls in the Joy Van. I attended the assemblies and joined in mocking them when I was with my humanist friends, but the Joy Movement drove a wedge between me and my Christian friends. Shortly after Dee arrived, I was told that, being a Mormon, there was no room for me in the Bible study group because I wasn't a Christian. I lost half my friends in one horrible Thursday morning. So, who was I, aside from a newly baptized convert to the Church of the First Amendment? I thought I was Christian. In fact, I thought of myself more as a Christian than a Mormon. Wayne Johnson, my best friend in the world, was a Mormon, but he attended the other high school in town, and we really only saw each other on Sundays. And those were only the Sundays when I made it to church. My father owned both a speedboat and a sailboat, and in those pre-3-hour block days, when we had Sunday school in the mornings and sacrament meeting in the evening, we didn't always make it back in time for church. I didn't much know what we even believed. My ignorance wasn't helped by the fact that it was so easy to blow off Home Studies Seminary, which consisted of a large notebook full of lessons and workbooks. The idea was that I was supposed to get up on my own every morning at 6 and fill out these workbooks. Yeah, that wasn't going to happen. Then, every Sunday, instead of Sunday school, we met with a seminary teacher, I'll call him Brother Jones, and we're supposed to turn those workbooks in for a grade. Then he'd teach a summary of the lessons we were supposed to have done all week, which nobody had. During my sophomore year in 1972, the AP Civics teacher, Mr. Hurt, did a unit on Vietnam. He turned it into a big debate. We divided into groups, took sides, and invited the school to this debate, moderated by 3 teachers. I was in the anti-war group, just by happenstance. Mr. Hurt had picked their groups randomly. Still, it's where I belonged. The war terrified me. I desperately hoped it would end before I turned 18 and entered the draft lottery. I volunteered for my first political campaign for George McGovern. We lost 49 states. Good practice for my future as a Utah County Democrat. And one Sunday, I asked Brother Jones how, as a Latter-day Saint, I could apply for conscientious objector status. He said, I couldn't. The church supported the war. Now, at that point, I didn't know that Mo Udall was Mormon. I didn't know about the principled objections to the war from many in the church. I only had Brother Jones, who I really liked and trusted. And what he said was appalling to me. My church, people who were my kind of Christians, supported the war. And so I thought, if that was true, then there really wasn't any way for me to stay Mormon. It wasn't just the war. The other big issue at the time was civil rights. Bloomington didn't have a large black population, but I had a few black friends and thought the movement was a great one. However, Indiana wasn't the best place to hold that view. 20 miles south of us was Martinsville, a town with no blacks at all. The star running back of our high school football team told me how, when he played Martinsville, some of the kids would hide broken glass in their uniforms and slice him up when they tackled him. He got his revenge by rushing for over 400 yards and scoring 8 touchdowns. He eventually played at Michigan State and for the Detroit Lions. Indiana was the only state in the country to have elected an open Klan member to the governorship. It was a terrific shock to learn that, as a Mormon, I was on the wrong side of equal rights, too. I don't remember how I learned of the priesthood ban, but I do remember how I felt. That Sunday, I was in anguish, asking Brother Jones, why? He said blacks had been disobedient in the pre-existence, fence sitters. And then he read a quote from President Benson about how blacks had been basically content with segregation until outside communist agitators got them all upset. My father wasn't an intellectual, but he was a smart, honest, good man, and so I went home and asked him what he thought of all this. He said, "I just have to think that's a mistake. The whole thing's just a big mistake. That pre-existent stuff doesn't sound right, and it doesn't feel right. I don't know the answer, but that's just wrong." My dad's discomfort helped a little. But if Mormons really were for the war and against civil rights, then why was I one? I went back to Brother Jones, and he challenged me to read the Book of Mormon. This struck me as a pretty roundabout answer to a straightforward question, but I thought, okay, fair enough, I should read it. We had a chart on the wall in our seminary classroom where we were supposed to color in a square for every chapter we read in the Book of Mormon, and I was in dead last with no squares colored in at all. So I sat down one week and began reading. And I felt good. It also felt good to color in all those squares the next Sunday. Some of the Book of Mormon was wonderful, especially King Benjamin's speech on caring for the poor. But what I really remember is how I felt. Peaceful. Happy. When I hit Moroni 10:3-5, I didn't even bother to pray. I'd done that years before, going out into the woods to pray about the truthfulness of the gospel, learning only that if you go out into the Indiana woods in the summer and kneel down, the chiggers are going to eat you alive. Joseph Smith had to fight off the darkness of the adversary in the sacred grove, but I couldn't even handle a few buzzing gnats. My ankles itched for weeks. I didn't need to pray. I didn't know what the feelings meant. I only knew I wanted more. A popular book at the time was Jim Bouton's Ball 4, probably the first baseball insider tell-all. It was great, funny and profane and smart. But then I noticed something. When I read the Book of Mormon, and I read it cover to cover 3 times my junior year in high school, I felt good. When I read Ball 4, that feeling went away. I do it on purpose. Read this for an hour, good feelings. Read that for an hour, good feelings gone. The conclusion I might have reached from this is an obvious one. Spiritual books invite the spirit. Worldly books reject the spirit. So, avoid worldly books. But in fact, I kept reading Ball 4, and it's still a book I love. I don't think the Lord was saying, "This is a good book, this is a bad book." I think he was saying, "This is a good book, this is a better book." In time, the same great feeling I got from the Book of Mormon came to me when I read other things. A Man for All Seasons, for example. I was an actor in those days, had leading roles in every school play. I found that a prayer would give me a good Book of Mormon feeling that would help me manage my stage fright. It was a useful little feeling. Seminary then was much the same as seminary now. We got the usual lessons about avoiding worldly music, and worldly movies, and worldly media, and, I suppose, worldly books. All of my children tell me that they've had seminary lessons in which they were challenged to bring their CD collections or iPods to class and burn worldly CDs or delete worldly tunes. Brother Jones, as it happens, had heard a talk about avoiding rock music and felt guilty about the contents of his record collection. His approach was to reject worldly music not by burning his records, but by giving them to me. Somehow in this mind it was okay to give these evil albums to one of the high school kids he was teaching. And that was logic I was completely okay with. And dude, he had some good stuff. For example, there was Leonard Bernstein's Mass, which has been described as a Catholic Mass written by a Jewish composer for Protestants. It's a musical examination of a crisis of faith in a secular society. It has bad language and rock music. and it's the most powerfully spiritual piece of music I know. Also in his stack was the soundtrack to the musical Jesus Christ Superstar. My dad took me to a performance of Superstar, and afterward we talked about how powerfully it showed the atoning mission of the Savior. Because we lived in Bloomington, I was completely awash in music. The Indiana University School of Music was, if not the finest music school in the world, at least in the top five, and they built their program on opera. By the time I was 18, I had seen excellent professional quality productions of most of the major operas. Every summer, the opera program staged one really big opera in the football stadium, including a production of Aida with real elephants. My favorite opera was The Flying Dutchman, partly because my dad was usually in it. The Dutchman was one of his favorite roles, and partly because in the IU production, when the Dutchman's ship arrived, the bowsprit would come crashing down over the first five rows, which, as a five-year-old, I thought was completely awesome. But it wasn't just opera. When my wife and I moved back to Bloomington so that I could go to grad school at Indiana, the music school decided to perform all the Mozart piano concerti. So Annette and I took the kids. And let me tell you, Mozart wrote a lot of piano concerti. Bloomington also hosted an annual bluegrass festival, and we'd go sit in the grass and listen to all that country fiddling for hours. The town also hosted not one, but three annual folk music festivals. 15 miles east was the city of Nashville, Indiana, which followed its Tennessee namesake by having an Opry House. Every week, all summer long, top names in country music would perform. So we'd go and hear Loretta Lynn and Lynn Anderson, Conway Twitty and George Jones, Willie Nelson and Johnny Cash and Merle Haggard and David Allan Coe. And then, when I was in high school, our family took our annual summer trip to Utah to visit aunts and uncles and grandparents and cousins. There, my wicked, worldly cousin Steve asked if I wanted to go to a rock concert. Not wanting to seem uncool, I said sure. And so we went and saw Jethro Tull. They played for over 3 hours, two whole albums worth of music, Aqualung and Thick as a Brick. Of course, Brother Jones had given me Aqualung, but I hadn't listened to it yet. When we got home, I did. A marvelous examination of the need for the real atonement in a lost and fallen world. That was my first introduction to what we then called progressive rock, rock music performed by classically trained musicians. My dad didn't like rock music, and still doesn't, probably because of, rather than in spite of, my best efforts to get him to appreciate it. But I couldn't get enough. The early 70s was a great time for rock music, and I was in a perfect position to take advantage of it, as my good friend's father was a concert promoter. Can you imagine a cooler job for a friend's father to have? We got free tickets to essentially any concert we wanted to see. And since I was known to be LDS, all my friends' parents trusted me to be the designated driver. And since I was doing most of the driving, all my friends' parents insisted that my friends pay for my gas. It added up to a pretty sweet deal. Bloomington is within a 4-hour drive of Cincinnati, Louisville, Indianapolis, Chicago, and St. Louis. And Bloomington itself attracted a lot of top bands. We got to see everyone. All I had to do was drive. If Indiana is known for one thing aside from basketball, it's the Indianapolis 500 car race. And Bloomington was also home to the World of Outlaws stock car circuit. Indiana teenagers had plenty of bad driving examples to choose from. State Road 37 from Bloomington to Indianapolis had more traffic fatalities than any other state highway in America, despite the fact that it was 4 lanes and perfectly straight. I had a 65 Ford Fairlane, 8 cylinders and 383 horses under the hood, and while it was perfectly true that as an LDS youth I didn't smoke or drink or do drugs, that didn't necessarily mean I was a safe driver. pushing 180 on a two-lane highway, passing semis on hills and around blind corners, I could do Bloomington to Indianapolis in 28 minutes, and Bloomington to Cincy in 88. I can still do it. My best time from Provo to Cedar City is 83 minutes. We'd play rock and roll as loud as it would go and bomb along narrow Indiana highways, fishtailing around every curve. I never hit anyone, I was never in an accident, and I never got a ticket. Which is not to say that we didn't come pretty close to seeing the face of God a few times. It was here that I learned the difference between the spirit and euphoria. Because driving really fast with rock and roll playing very loudly can lead to euphoric experiences. Until a few years ago, I drove as a way to overcome writer's block. I'd be stuck trying to work out a scene or a chapter or a transition, and I'd get in my car and bomb down I-15 toward Nephi, 90-plus miles an hour, playing the loudest music I could find on the radio, overloading on pure adrenaline. Then I'd go home, back to my computer, and lo and behold, my subconscious had solved the writing problem. A few years ago, there was a stake priesthood meeting, and I really didn't want to go. I don't know about you guys, but for me, stake priesthood meeting is the very definition of a meeting to have a meeting, and therefore, the very definition of optional. But my wife thought I should go, and she thought I should take my oldest son. Set a good example. I decided she was right, and my son, Kai, and I reluctantly and slowly put on our ties. I don't wear suits. I don't even own a suit. But I do have ties, all of them by Jerry Garcia. And we made it out to my car. We sat there, glumly, trying to motivate ourselves to go to stake priesthood meeting, until I turned on the car radio and turned to the heavy metal station. AC/DC was on, playing Hell's Bells, if memory serves. We started a little headbanging motion. I put the car in gear, and off we went to stake priesthood. AC/DC led to Poison, then Def Leppard, then Motley Crue, and we were energized, excited, euphoric. AC/DC got us to stake priesthood meeting. And we really enjoyed the meeting, participated with enthusiasm, learned a lot. But that's another chapter in the discerning of spirits. When I was a kid, driving wildly on the narrow Indiana highways, playing Brownsville Station or Led Zeppelin, passing on hills and around blind corners, I experienced something, and it felt good. It was euphoria. Meanwhile, the spirit was whispering to me, "Ah, don't pass that guy yet. Wait a bit. That one's a little dangerous." The spirit was the useful feeling, the one that had my best interests at heart, the one busy keeping me alive. So we'd go to concerts, me and my friends, and the concerts we attended. We saw the Stones and the Who and Led Zeppelin. We saw Jethro Tull twice, and yes, twice, and Genesis when Peter Gabriel was still with them in their Selling England by the Pound days. We saw Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. We saw King Crimson and Eric Clapton. We saw Elvis, old and fat, poured into his jumpsuit, but still working his magic. We saw Oregon and the Mahavishnu Orchestra. We saw Bob Dylan and the band. Above all, we saw Gentle Giant. Nobody's ever heard of them anymore, but they were our favorite band. Astounding musicians. That was my life. A life absolutely immersed in music. Classical music, folk and country, rock and roll, prog rock and country rock. And what I concluded, and what I still believe to be true today, is that the idea that there are two kinds of music, two kinds of art, worldly art and spiritual art, is utter and complete nonsense. All art is worldly, and all art is spiritual. It all invites the spirit. It all leads to euphoria and joy and every emotion known to man. To embrace classical music and reject jazz, or to embrace the Tabernacle Choir and reject doo-wop, or to embrace Josh Groban and reject Steven Tyler is simply nonsense. If there's anything virtuous, lovely, or of good report and praiseworthy, then call it art and just bask. We hear it today, People my age will say, well, the Beatles and the Stones, that's good music. This rap stuff is terrible. Rap, they just left off the first letter C. And I think, have you heard Jay-Z? Have you heard Eminem or Tupac? It's all worldly, and it's all spiritual, and it all invites the spirit, and it all rejects the spirit, and it all leads to joy, and it all leads to pain sometimes too. So I read the Book of Mormon and found that I liked feeling the spirit. The music that surrounded me filled me with joy and the spirit. Meanwhile, I was acting in school plays and seeing every movie I could. The conclusion I reached from all of it was simple. I liked feeling the spirit, and I learned to cultivate it, to use it effectively. One more high school experience. I loved Gentle Giant, but the guy I admired more than anyone was Bob Dylan, and he came to Bloomington. I bought 2 tickets the day they went on sale, and I counted down the days until he came. I mean that figuratively. It would have been better if I had actually consulted a calendar, because 2 weeks before the concert, I suddenly realized that it was on a Sunday. So I went to my mom, and I told her, hey, I've got this dilemma. It's Dylan. I've got my tickets. I've got a date. And it's on a Sunday. And she said, look, we're LDS. We honor the Sabbath. We don't go to concerts on Sundays, but you've got your agency. We've taught you the difference between right and wrong. I hope you make the right choice. Darn her. So, of course, I went to the concert. I mean, come on, man, it was Bob Dylan. Of course I went to the concert. But I didn't much enjoy it. Felt too guilty. And the spirit really did go away for a while. So I learned something else about the spirit, about agency and choices and consequences. Music and art and theater and literature remain the main ways for me to access the spirit, and I really do think I've learned how to distinguish between the spirit and euphoria. The best art invites the spirit most strongly, and that is just as true in my experience when it's R-rated. My high school experiences taught me 2 lessons that I've clung to my whole life. First, the Book of Mormon invites the spirit. That is to say, reading it engenders feelings that seem to me to have been externally generated. Though I still had doubts and questions, I liked the way the Book of Mormon felt. The other thing I learned was that the brethren, the leaders of the church, are capable of making mistakes. They hold ideas that reflect their culture, their time and place in the world, especially when it comes to big social political issues. Those who supported the war in Vietnam were wrong to do so. Those who opposed civil rights were wrong to do so. As much as I knew that reading the Book of Mormon led to certain feelings, I also knew that thinking about the idea that black people were being punished for pre-existent disobedience led to a sick feeling, a horrid, awful ugliness. I could trust that feeling too, just as much as the happier ones I got from King Benjamin or Father Lehi. Later, I felt the same way about the church's opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment. The institution had gotten another one wrong. This was true on my mission as well. I learned that if I trusted those good King Benjamin-y feelings, I could actually get good things done. I also learned that the general authorities over our mission weren't always right, and sometimes were spectacularly wrong. There was, for example, the case of the Dusseldorf door approach. The regional general authority over our mission spoke at a mission conference and recommended that we try a new door approach that had apparently been very successful in Dusseldorf. The approach went like this. We had these small white cards saying we were official ministers in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. One missionary would get right up by the door, and when a person answered it, stick his foot into the door opening, shove that ID card right in the face of whoever answered, and declare, I am an official representative of Jesus Christ. I have a message for you from Jesus Christ. He commands you to hear our message. Can we come in?" The other missionary stood in the background holding up a picture of Jesus from our flip charts. Then, no matter what the person at the door said, the missionary with his foot in the door was supposed to repeat, "Jesus Christ commands you to let us into your home." Since I was the district leader, I thought I'd take the lead. So my companion and I committed ourselves to trying the new door approach for an entire morning. We learned some things. For example, when you were the missionary in the back holding the picture of Jesus, you felt stupid and useless because you couldn't do much to help your companion on the front line. But when it was your turn to hold that ID badge and stick your foot in the door and command people to let you into their homes, well, I never want to feel like that again in my life. The good doors were the ones where they laughed at you. "You what? Please, get lost, loser." Mostly, people just got really angry. They'd back away, startled, and then they'd tell you to get your foot out of the door now and threaten to call the police. And then they did it! We scrambled behind a tree when we saw a police car slowly patrolling the neighborhood we were working. But even the doors where people got really angry and called the cops weren't the worst doors. I served in Norway from 1975 to 1977, just 30 years after the Second World War, and a number of the older people still remembered the Nazi occupation. We saw it on some of their faces that morning. That old, horrible fear reawakened. We could see it in their eyes. Those were the worst doors. The ones where I understood in my gut, in my soul, what it would feel like to knock on their door in the middle of the day, to take them by surprise, to stick a badge in their face, to shout orders, to arrest them. I'll admit this too. There was sometimes a moment, just a tiny second, when it was sort of thrilling, when I felt a little buzz of self-righteous power, when I felt like a member of God's secret police. When we went home for lunch, my companion told me that he couldn't take it anymore. I couldn't either. I talked with my zone leader about it. "He's a general authority," I said. "Shouldn't we exercise faith? Shouldn't we obey? Shouldn't we keep trying until it works?" "It's never going to work," he replied. "We either quit now or we quit when the cops or someone makes us quit. It's a bad door approach. It doesn't respect people. It's coercive. It's unrighteous. Maybe it worked in Dusseldorf, though I doubt it. But in Norway? Not a chance."
"But he's a general authority," I said weakly.
"Yeah," said our zone leader, "and a guy with a really bad idea for a door approach." And that was the end of it. I came to realize that this particular general authority was a person, human like me, struggling to live by the Spirit, like I was. We were the worst baptizing mission in the church. Maybe he thought a stronger door approach would help. I didn't. But that's okay. Mistakes happen. We learn from them and move on to the next thing. And besides, while it's true that the brethren can be wrong on occasion, look at what they get right. I'm not just talking about the 1978 revelation lifting priesthood and temple restriction, which, to my mind, just corrected something that was never anything but a colossal, appalling mistake. Think about the Perpetual Education Fund, hurricane relief, earthquake relief, tsunami relief. Just a week ago, I was talking to a friend who told me about his new calling in the church as an administrator for a program to provide free health care for the poor. 3 nights a week, for 5 hours a night, doctors and nurses and other healthcare professionals get together and provide free health care for people with no other recourse. Patients with long-term problems get treated and referred to other agencies where they can get continuing help. Free medications and supplies are donated by Intermountain Healthcare. He estimates that 90% of the patients they see are illegal immigrants, but he doesn't know for sure because that's not what's on his mind. His task is to help people. That's the church. That's what the church can accomplish.
And have you noticed the church's stance on the illegal immigration debate? Calls for compassion and civility? I think I can read that code. This article is supposed to be about the maturing of faith. And for me, a mature faith must necessarily have an intellectual dimension. It certainly did for Joseph Smith, the illiterate farm boy on fire to learn Hebrew, Greek, and German. Before my mission, I was appallingly ignorant of the main intellectual currents in Mormon culture. But when I got to BYU, professors and friends turned me on to Hugh Nibley and Jean England, Leonard Arrington and Juanita Brooks, and Mormon history generally. The science versus religious problem that still derails some of my students was never an issue for me because my stake president in high school was Hollis Johnson, a preeminent astrophysicist who just didn't have patience with anti-intellectualism and who gave firesides from time to time to combat it. So I was lucky there. But the discovery of a larger LDS intellectual community was tremendously exciting. I no longer felt alone. I didn't have to skip the Shakespeare study group to play cards with Christians anymore. I didn't have to feel torn between two groups. I could just find simpatico friends of my own. It was like that wonderful day in the LTM when I discovered one other missionary there who also hated Saturday's Warrior. Kindred spirits! This is supposed to be about a mature faith, and here I am talking about high school. But the fact is, I don't know that I've grown much from high school. Those twin insights, the spirit feels great, the brethren make mistakes but also get a lot right too, remain about the only two things I've really figured out. What's happened, I think, is that I've grown reluctant to draw hasty conclusions based on scanty evidence. I've become more aware of the language of our worship and the rhetorical strategies we employ. In Mormonism, we're supposed to bear our testimonies that the Book of Mormon is true, that the church is true, that we're led by a prophet on the earth today. We seem to feel that merely saying we believe in God is inadequate. We must know God exists and that he has restored his church to the earth today. I know all these phrases. I've even used them. But I don't particularly want to anymore. Not because I don't treasure the times I feel the Spirit, treasure those moments when a whisper or feeling leads me somewhere unexpected, but because I feel the need to be careful, to be completely honest, to not overstate things. Strong rhetorical stances speak to me of insecurity, not certainty. So we bear testimony. But what are we testifying to? A certain narrative? The first vision, the restoration of the church, the golden plates and their translation? Even though we seem to be saying that certain historical events really happened, the fact is, we weren't there. And all the people who were there are long dead. It seems to me that the most we can say is, I received a spiritual manifestation that persuades me that these events took place. We're saying that we prayed, and feelings resulted that seem to us to have been externally generated. And then we testify that the Book of Mormon is true, a rather strange thing to say. We don't say Middlemarch is true, or Hamlet is true. We don't even say that Kant's Critique of Pure Reason is true, or Newton's Principia is true. When we say the Book of Mormon is true, in other words, we're saying something pretty complicated. The Book of Mormon might be true in the sense that it describes people who really lived, a civilization that actually existed. It might be true in a theological sense, the sermons included in its pages accurately describing God and how he wants us to serve him and each other. It might be true in an existential sense. The book came into being in a particular way, involving golden plates and an angel and a Urim and Thummim. It might be true in a spiritual sense. In fact, I think that's how we generally understand it. Of course, we also think that there really were golden plates and that there really were Nephites, but that's all just assumed, unexamined. We're supposed to read the Book of Mormon for a certain amount of time each day, 15 minutes, a half hour, as an act of devotion. It's how we develop spiritual discipline, It's our rosary. It's our mantra. It's not like other books. We're not supposed to read it for pleasure, for a story, for its prose. We can, of course, but that's not the point. I read the Book of Mormon, and I feel certain feelings, and those feelings lead to other, similar feelings. And in my experience, the Spirit is useful. Thoughts pop into my head. My daughter has a fever and a sore throat, but it's the weekend and we can't see our regular doctor for a day or so. Should we take her to the emergency room? I lay my hands on her head, and a thought occurs to me. She's pretty sick, but we can wait until Monday. Meanwhile, we should go to the store and get a can of chicken noodle soup. We should give her ibuprofen and a fruit smoothie. Would I have reached these conclusions anyway, on my own? Quite possibly, but they did pop into my head while I was praying, my hands laid on my daughter's head. So, tentative conclusions, carefully parsed testimonials. And then I got sick. A few years ago, I was diagnosed with an incurable muscular degenerative autoimmune disease called polymyositis. My legs hurt a lot. For a long time, I couldn't drive a car. Sometimes, I don't see very well. And my hands hurt. It's hard to write for more than a couple of hours at a time. I can't walk 100 yards. A few weeks ago, I realized how difficult it would be for me to get in an airplane, and how hard it is to ride in a car for more than a couple of hours, and I had a horrifying realization. I will probably never leave Utah. Ever. For the rest of my life. That is a truly terrifying thought. I'm not a Hoosier anymore. I'm a Utahan. Shudder. I can live with that, actually. But what's interesting are the ways in which my illness has complicated my testimony. In February 2008, I was president of the Association for Mormon Letters. We were preparing for our big yearly academic conference. Terrell Givens was our keynote speaker. A couple of months before the conference, Terrell let us know that the date we'd scheduled for the conference in mid-March was impossible for him. Could we meet in late February instead? This was, of course, a very difficult request to meet. I should point out, by the way, that Terrell was very apologetic and great about the whole thing. But conferences are hard. They take a lot of work. Could we move everything up? Boyd Peterson and I took a deep breath and decided to try. Now, the whole time we were working on the conference, I was getting sick. I knew I was in bad shape, but with so much work to do, I didn't have time to see a doctor just yet. I promised my wife I would go in as soon as the conference was over, and I did. When the doctor saw me walk in the room, he ordered some tests, got them back, and slammed me immediately in the hospital with acute kidney failure and congestive heart failure, complications of polymyositis. If Terrell Givens had not asked us to move the conference back 2 weeks, I quite possibly could have died. The scriptures say we should acknowledge the hand of God in all things. Did God work through Terrell to save my life? Part of me thinks so. But that same 2 weeks that saved my life was also a time of unspeakable suffering in Darfur, of massive horror in Kashmir, of death and disease from AIDS all over West Africa. Why in the world would God intervene on my puny behalf? I was in the hospital for a week. On Sunday, two quite elderly men came into my room and asked if I would like the sacrament. I said I would. We sang a hymn together, and then they brought out a cup of water and a small piece of bread. One of these brethren, he looked at least 80, very slowly and creakily kneeled to bless the bread and water. Watching this humble old man struggle to kneel and struggle to get back up, all on my behalf, made my eyes fill with tears. I felt, in that moment, the meaning of grace. I don't know if God prompted Terrell Givens to save my life. I do know that God sent these two wonderful brothers to serve me and the other patients in the hospital. That was their calling. I used to dislike and resent church. Now I want to go, even on Sundays when the medications I have to take every Friday are still in my system, when I feel completely exhausted and sick. It's hard for me to sit on the hard wooden benches in our ward house, so the bishop has instructed the teachers to bring in one of the comfortable chairs from the lobby just for me. Jean England wrote once that the church is as true as the gospel. I now know what he meant, having been the beneficiary of so many acts of kindness and love from my brothers and sisters. Father Lehi also wrote about how there must needs be opposition in all things. The plan of salvation requires that we experience difficulty and illness and pain. I always understood that intellectually. Now I feel it in my bones. The Book of Mormon sometimes seems a pretty obvious 19th century text. But historicity issues have become immaterial to me. Do I know the Book of Mormon is true? I'm hesitant to put it that way. But reading it, I feel things I don't ordinarily feel. Some tranquility, perhaps. Some compassion. Some connection to Nephi and Benjamin and Ammon and the Savior. Characters in a story, words on a page, but also thoughts in my head, feelings in my heart, and acts of love. I don't think Mormons say in sickness and in health in the temple ceiling. Actually, what the guy said when I got married is pretty much a blur to me. What I do know is that Annette got the short end of the sickness and health stick. She gets to deal with my sickness, and I get the benefit of her health, and that's just plain unfair. Not that she's ever complained. Not ever. Not once. For Annette, faith is works and works is faith. Which job should I start with and where can I find a mop? And so, I've come to think that what I want just doesn't matter. I need to get to the point where what I want is the lowest priority, the last consideration. I'm not there yet, not by a long shot, but that's what the Spirit tells me. Patience. And then after that, more patience. And after that, a whole lot more patience. Not long ago, a general conference talk asserted that doubt is not a gospel principle. But how can that be? Pain is a gospel principle. Weakness is a gospel principle. Sore legs and hurting hands and an inability to walk 100 yards are all gospel principles. They lead me to humility, to patience, to learning. They are for my benefit. They give me experience. They're for my good. After all, my Savior descended below them all, didn't he? So doubt must be an essential part of the gospel. I have to work through doubt, come to the edge of the cliff and see the white water break on the rocks below. That's when I can sometimes close my eyes and jump. When I most need God to catch me, he does. I feel like St. Augustine, cheering in his school of philosophical disputes whenever those arguing for the immortality of the soul won the day. I have a rooting interest. I don't know a lot. I do know how I feel when I read the Book of Mormon, and how I feel when I go to church and see the comfy chair carefully placed in the chapel just for me, by kids younger than any of my kids, just trying to serve a brother. I can say I absolutely know what that feels like. And sometimes, just a little, I get the tiniest sense of what my Savior did for me. I used to wonder when reading Mosiah 2 through 4 if I was reading the words of a real man. Now I think of that old brother struggling to kneel to give me the sacrament, and I know what King Benjamin meant by Christ-like service. Benjamin lives for me, not in my mind, but in my heart. So does the Lehi of 2 Nephi 2 through 4. Opposition in all things? I am sicker than I have ever been in my life, an illness that's likely to kill me someday. And I count it a great blessing from my Father in heaven. So do I believe the Book of Mormon is true? I believe it. That's all. I just believe. I don't know. But that belief is enough. Meanwhile, is there something I can do? Can I love and serve my brothers and sisters? My testimony is built on a foundation of illness and pain, an old man kneeling, an experiment with two books, music and literature, movies and plays, Gene England and Tom Rogers as much as Spencer Kimball and Gordon Hinckley, great teachers and great students, struggles to walk, to drive, to write. Feelings that I may have made up, but I don't think so. Daniel Ludlow and Ray Hardesty, planting and harvesting sorghum of the soul. Things that used to matter don't. Issues I used to care about seem much less urgent. Meanwhile, when I read the Book of Mormon, it feels good. When I'm able to serve, even a little, it feels wonderful. That's plenty for me to cling to. That was The Roots of My Faith by Eric Samuelson. The text version of this article includes Joseph Smith's record collection. That concludes this episode of the Sunstone Magazine podcast. Encourage your friends to join us by becoming a patron at patreon.com/sunstone. If you would like to further support Sunstone's efforts, visit sunstone.org/donate, where you can make a tax-deductible contribution. We'll be back soon with another installment of the best of Mormon thought and experience. Thanks for listening.